What is the thing that keeps you up at night? Is it that Canada becomes irrelevant on the global stage? Is it we fall behind technologically so that every other country outpaces us and we just become a natural resource seller and that's it? Like, what's the nightmare scenario here for you? And this might be the theme of the episode here. Christian's nightmare scenario.
We're living the nightmare, as far as I'm concerned. Because I look for a politician in Ottawa that actually has a vision for where they want this country to be in 10, 20, 30 years from now. And that actually develops a strategy and a plan of how we make sure we actually get there. You know, we're always critical. We're always quick to criticize everyone else, right?
Just a heads up. This episode ties into a previous episode we did. If you listen back to episode 1 with Phil Gursky, we talked a lot about stories and how they shape our understanding. This episode expands a bit more on what Phil was talking about when it comes to how Canada sees itself in the larger security world. You know, it's funny, recording this interview, I was reminded of my childhood. When I was a kid growing up in the 90s, we had these funny 60-second commercials in Canada called Heritage Minutes.
Commandant Cartier, you say, this nation's name is Canada.
Canada.
They would be played as ads during Saturday morning cartoons. They actually still make them. And these little vignettes basically told these like little snippet stories
no
of Canada's history.
Driven by a strong man in tights, Joe. It'll never fly.
Fly, no. But he can leap over tall buildings. Oh, wow, yeah.
Some were amazing, some were cheesy as hell, and some, in hindsight, definitely came off as racist and offensive. But to be honest, they hold this bizarre and special place in my heart.
Burnt toast. Dr. Penfield, I can smell burnt toast.
They were this great example of how stories can be used to shape us. And that is the funny thing about stories. They're powerful. And used properly, a story can be a building block for hope or a weapon of war. A story can shape how we think about other people or ourselves and our place in the world. So for me, this bright-eyed kid living on the prairies in Canada, I always held this story in my heart, that I lived in the greatest country ever. It was safe and beautiful, and all that other stuff, the bad stuff from the news, the fighting, the wars, the natural disasters, all that was somewhere else. And Canada was this safe haven, this paradise, this castled kingdom fortified from all the bad guys out there.
We've built arguably the most politically stable, the most economically prosperous, the most socially harmonious, and arguably the most desirable continent the world has ever known to live in. And my worry is we've forgotten the very strategy that got us to where we are today.
And that's another funny thing about stories. We can easily forget them as well. This is Cloak and Dagger, a podcast about OSINT, technology, and global conflict. I'm MJ Benias. The podcast is powered by Sapper Labs Group. For more, visit www.sapperlabs.com.
So my name is Christian Leuprecht, and my regular day job is as a professor at the Royal Military College. I also run an institute at in the School of Policy Studies at Queen's University, the Institute of Intergovernmental Relations. So I inherently have an interest in governance issues. I'm also a senior fellow with the MacDonald Laurier Institute, and I'm also the editor-in-chief of the flagship Canadian military journal. I guess for the purpose of our conversation here, I also co-direct the Queen's RMC NSERC, so National Science and National Science Engineering Research Council of Canada funded certificate in cybersecurity, for which I'm the social science co-director. So I have a longstanding interest in the complementarity between the social sciences and the technical sciences when it comes to the space.
We can sum all this up with: Christian is an expert in Canada's current role in the broader world when it comes to security, defense, and intelligence. Honestly, he's written papers and books on intelligence gathering, cybersecurity, defense doctrine, national security, you name it. And all this research and work has pointed Christian to a major theme in this story.
This is sort of the deep defense sort of element, which sort of we refer to sort of the castle model, trying to take apart what was then still sort of the prevailing sort of mode that we can keep people out of the castle. And sort of this article is really about showing empirically that the enemy is inside the gates. So sort of anybody who thinks you can keep them outside the castle is clearly deluded. So how do you need to change your predisposition when you know that the enemy is in the gates, and you have to assume that your networks and your data is compromised? So for people to wrap their head around that, the enemy was in our networks and the enemy was already actively compromising our data, whether it's state or non-state actors. And of course, what we've learned since then, this isn't just a problem in the network and the data space. It is an actual problem in our society as well, in the way hostile, in particular, state actors are looking to undermine on a broad scale our democratic institutions, our prosperity, our social harmony, our diplomacy, our defense, our security, our cyberspace. I think for most listeners, for most Canadians, this is a fairly new phenomenon that they're sort of being confronted with now that we have newspapers reporting on this.
Right. And all this stuff can be confusing for a lot of people. So let's take a step back. At the top of this episode, I talked about stories as ways to compel action or inaction. We have this story in Canada, and really in the West too, where all the bad things are far away. They happen in these far-off lands and don't make much of an impact here. That there is a bit of a fantasy. Is Canada safer than a lot of places? Yes, of course it is. But is it immune to the world's problems? As Christian sees it, in this defense of our castle here, the enemy is inside the gates, and they've been there for quite some time. They scoop up our data, they try to barter, buy, or blackmail influence, they create mis- and disinformation in our social networks, they radicalize our young people, and even meddle in our government elections.
In practice, if you look back, for instance, to CSIS reports, so the first mention of China in a CSIS report dates back to 1995. And at that point, already concern about Chinese intelligence activities in this country, Chinese espionage activities, as well as possible links between triad gangs and Chinese intelligence. And so these are all elements that we're discovering more broadly, for instance, how the Chinese state leverages, instrumentalizes the broader Chinese diaspora for its purposes, whether wittingly by coercing students, for instance, to protest, even though that might not be their wish or their will, or unwittingly by spinning narratives about that any action against subversion is actually racism against China. As you might know, I recently wrote an op-ed on this in the National Post that it's really China that's being racist. I mean, look at the way China treats communities of Tibetan, Uyghur, Hong Kong democracy activists, and so forth. So this also, I think, has been my effort for several years to try to explain to Canadians that this is indeed a broader effort across to undermine our way of life, our democratic way of life, and the things that we cherish on a broad scale, in order to weaken us as a country and to weaken us as a member of both the Western Alliance as well as the NATO military alliance.
You may recall this from our first episode with Phil Gursky, the Chinese government's interference in the Canadian political system. It's definitely a hot-button issue in Canada right now. But the Chinese government isn't alone. The Russian government is also targeting Canada. A vast number of cyber attacks have been mounted against Canada by Russia in recent years. I mean, just recently, in April, Russian state hackers targeted Canadian government websites in an attempt to basically bring them offline. They hit the websites of the Pearson International Airport. They even hit a national bank. So while this recent spate of attacks is more of a nuisance, it still points to a very simple reality that Canada is not immune or free from all this trouble out there in the world. But there's that lingering story that everyone likes Canada. Well, it's become reflected in our policies and how we have chosen to fortify this castle.
My favorite way to describe this is rather homeopathic. We have a rather homeopathic national security, intelligence, and defense apparatus. We invest relatively little. We're the one G7 country that doesn't have a foreign human collection service. Under Section 12, CSIS has, of the Act, CSIS has some and more foreign collection capabilities than people are probably aware of. But nonetheless, we've always tried to do this the easy way and on the cheap, in part on the premise that, look, we share the continent with the United States, so anything that's a threat to the United States is a threat to us. So ultimately, I think there's a sense of, you know, we have this close relationship where it's in the American interest to protect us and to share with us. But look, we live in a dangerous and rapidly changing world, and in a world where we as a country have national interests that increasingly diverge from that of the United States. And so intelligence is about a matter of protecting your own institutions, your own economy, your own society, but it's also an instrument to assert your own interests broadly, right? So the United States is a superpower, has an interest in preserving a balance of power, whereas middle powers such as Canada, their main interest is to assert their interests and to provide a sense of status quo in terms of the international rules-based order and institutions that have significantly worked to our advantage over recent decades. But our main objective is not to preserve or to assert sort of a balance of power. And so our investments are necessarily sort of somewhat different. The problem is, of course, in the space that what you bring to the table in many ways determines the voice that you have, whether you have a voice at the table and the voice that you have at that table. And so Canada simply sort of riding it out more or less with what we've always spent or a little bit less in an increasingly more demanding environment, both in terms of geostrategic instability and uncertainty, but also more demanding in terms of what our key allies and partners are asking of us, means that at some tables now, we don't have a voice at all.
Yeah, I mean, this makes sense, right? If you want to play at the poker table, you need to buy in. And it's not like Canada doesn't have the chips.
You can see that our allies in some key areas, take AUKUS, for instance.
Right, AUKUS. AUKUS. A quick glossary check here. It is a security arrangement made between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States. AUKUS. AUKUS. Get it? Yeah, I know. They should hire someone to do the name things. Anyway, this arrangement, the one that Canada really should have been involved in but isn't, it focuses on keeping allied countries ahead of the national security curve. Yes, there is a component about nuclear-powered submarines and intelligence sharing, but it goes way beyond that, into the bleeding edge of technological development, into cybersecurity, quantum computing technology, artificial intelligence.
It's arguably the single most important technology sharing agreement signed in the last 50 years. And if we want to have a high-tech economy, we want to be part of high-tech technology sharing agreements. So we're not just opting out of security arrangements, we're also opting out of the ability, you know, this point that I made about innovation, productivity sort of earlier, where clearly that seems not to be a priority. So yes, we can let our partners run with that. But the challenge is that means we are rapidly diminishing our voice in terms of the ability to shape an increasingly challenged and uncertain environment. So if we're not investing and if we're not part of, if we're being left out of these type of arrangements, it means that we're also going to be increasingly drafting behind our allies.
Okay, but why? I mean, artificial intelligence and quantum computing are both literally the next economic and technological holy grails. Cybersecurity is pretty much a basic need now for any nation. Why aren't we getting in on this?
As you might guess, it's a complex problem. So Canada has long, of course, in terms of its industrial policy, not done a particularly great job at fostering a high-tech economy, contrary to what governments in this country will tell you. Look at how many of our fantastic startups that we have that then get bought out, for instance, by US-based companies. So really, we're just, you know, a branch plant of the United States. We don't particularly do particularly well in terms of technology and IP transfer. We invest significant amounts of money in developing fantastic technology that we don't then have a very effective way of either keeping in Canadian hands or even transferring that technology to Canadian hands to begin with. But there's a lot of inertia in that regard. Strategically, there's no votes to be had in foreign policy. Arguably, the only election we've ever had where, in the last century at least, where foreign policy has mattered was the 1988 free trade election, for those of you who are old enough to remember that. And you might argue that even that was really a domestic trade sort of continental issue, not really a foreign policy issue per se. So governments notoriously know if they can't, they can't garner votes on foreign policy, but they can lose votes on foreign policy. So they prefer to stay away from topics that could be controversial, especially in a diverse country such as Canada. And governments have taken that to heart. And look, we live in a very diverse country. Imagine if we actually had a sovereign foreign policy and we had an honest conversation among Canadians with what that policy should look like. That could be a rather divisive conversation if you can see how communities are already divided over some foreign policy aspects of this country. So I think politicians look at this and staffers look at this and go, oh, that's going to be hard. Maybe we just won't do this. So I think this is part of sort of why we dabble and why we don't invest.
Right. So basically, much like any holiday family dinner, someone starts a conversation about something slightly controversial, and then it all gets political real fast.
But I also think more broadly, the international security environment over the last 25 years has become immensely complex, right? The Cold War was easy, right? We had an enemy. Everybody knew what the enemy was. You know, if you looked at our intelligence and national security and our defense sort of entities, they sort of knew what the objective was, right? There was one clear target. There was one clear hostile actor, whether that was the country itself or Soviet actions around the globe. And that's what it meant to deter and contain and so forth. Look at the proliferation of state and non-state threats and actors, the types of threats that we've had since the end of the Cold War, and especially over the last 25 years. And if you think it's going to get better, I've got news for you. The last 30 years were just a warm-up for what's about to come. So this is just the trailer for what we're confronting. And I think politicians, this is hard stuff for politicians. You know, you really got to wrap your head around this. You got to immerse yourself. And I think it's not really what politicians are interested in. Politicians don't like to explain stuff that's complex to the public.
Ooh, this is getting spicy.
They want easy and simple things. So I think they themselves don't quite, many of them don't quite really understand and want to understand. It's not where their interest lies. It's not how they're going to get reelected. And so they kind of punt it off to these expert agencies. And as you can see, even when the expert agencies provide very good intelligence, as for instance about Chinese foreign interference in this country, politicians then are loath to action it.
Woo, this is making my palms sweat.
And Canada is not alone in that challenge, that we have pretty good intelligence agencies, domestic and international, but that politicians decide otherwise. And look, we live in a democracy, right? In a democracy, the people get to decide and the people get to be wrong. And I think the people so far have been rather wrong, especially in the last 20 years, about national security and our posture. The problem is the people also think that Canada is the greatest country in the world. And so you can't be a smart Canadian and tell the world that the world would be a better place if it would be just a little bit more like Canada, but then not invest in exactly those instruments that would actually allow to shape us the world in sort of the views, in the smart Canadian sort of views about, you know, how we're going to make the world a better place. So, you know, I think this is sort of the dissonance, the cognitive dissonance that Canadians are living with and that we either have to wake up to, that either we say, well, we're going to opt out of shaping the world because we feel we don't have anything to offer, or we feel with this G7 country that actually has moral, political, economic, social responsibilities, not just for our own well-being, but perhaps at least for our allies and partners and perhaps for the rest of the world. And if we feel those moral obligations, then we have to do more than just sit here and be preachy about a values-based foreign policy, but then we don't have any investments or any instruments to actually make good on those values. Because ultimately, these are, whether it's intelligence, national security, and especially defense.
Wow, I think Christian just dropped the mic. Honestly, I love when academics get fired up. But I think, you know, he's right about a lot of this. I mean, the world just seems way more complicated now. Security itself seems way more complicated. Now, full transparency here, much to the chagrin of my grade 11 social studies teacher, I pretty much learned the vast majority of my Canadian history via those little 60-second Heritage Minute videos I mentioned at the top, playing between episodes of Are You Afraid of the Dark and Jonavision on Saturday mornings. Of the Midnight Society. I want to circle back to something you said earlier, and I think this is really relevant to our audience. You mentioned the Cold War, and there was this clear understanding of who the bad guys were, who the good guys were, and that was it. Like it was easy delineation. We now, you know, live in this period where it's significantly more complicated. You have significantly more actors, both state and non-state, and not only that, during the Cold War, especially in the early days, you know, there was no internet. Misinformation and disinformation was a much more difficult play compared to today, where you can get a response to, let's say, propaganda or disinformation almost immediately. You can A-B test it. You could do all these things with the internet that you couldn't do in the 1950s and 60s and 70s and in the 80s with kind of the old classic methods of propaganda and disinformation spreading and all of that. I'd love to know your thoughts on how the internet has altered the landscape of all of this.
Yeah, I mean, you've democratized the information space, right? So what social media and the internet have done is that you've liberalized it in the sense that every individual can now seek out the information that they like, and that most people, as a result, live in a what sociologists call filter bubble, which we used to call an echo chamber. Where you seek out certain types of information and then the algorithm reinforces that information. Of course, most people not realizing that the algorithm tracks your IP address, your phone, your computer, your location, knows when you're born, knows where you shop, and so forth. So the algorithm is pretty darn good at figuring out how to target you. And bad actors have figured that out as well. And they know they don't need to reach the majority of Canadians, for instance. All they need to do is reach a certain subsection or a sub-slice of those Canadians. And the digital environment has made it much easier to identify those individuals and to understand how either to influence those individuals or to coerce those individuals.
Right. I mean, we have had the luxury over the last couple of years to watch how disinformation and misinformation spreads. We have groups dedicated to tracking and monitoring it. It is a massive part of the security and OSINT landscape. And honestly, it's also how some massive news corporations have made billions. I mean, look at Fox News getting sued for making claims that the US voting system was rigged, and they got slapped hard. It's just bizarre how information is so malleable.
I think Canada, we have the added problem compared to countries that live in a more challenging security environment that we've long, I think, had our head in the sands. We think the problems of the world are far away. You know, if you live in Europe, if you live in Asia, the Indo-Pacific, you've long known. You know, if you're in Australia, there's no debate. Like, look, when you're a country in terms of population economy are two-thirds the size of Canada, and you live within 1,500 miles of half the world's population, and most of those countries aren't all that friendly, you know where your bread is buttered. And when you've almost had an experience of being almost invaded in World War II, that changes your mindset in terms of how you go about things. So, you know, I think we've missed that. We've lived in this peaceable kingdom for so long that I think we somehow reproduce based on what we see in Canada. We think this is how the rest of the world sort of operates. Everybody's kind of nice to each other and sort of, and it just turns out it's just not the case. The rest of the world is actually a pretty darn dangerous place where security, defense, intelligence has been critical to maintaining the status quo.
Right. So Canada needs to step it up. We need to show up to the party, to be useful and just not expect others to do it for us.
Look, the way we've been able to make ourselves relevant is as a member of the G7, a member of NATO, a member of international institutions, and a loyal partner on this continent, where the United States and especially our European allies could rely on us. We provided certain capacities to them, whether that's deterrence, whether that's, for instance, natural resource exports that our partners desperately needed. But look, I mean, this country has decided we're not really going to invest in defense. This country has decided that even though our allies desperately need our natural resource exports, we're not going to, God forbid, we ever build any pipelines anywhere again. We'd rather have them procure hydrocarbons from human rights abusing authoritarian regimes in the Middle East and in South America, you know, even though they'd much rather, you know, procure them from us. And so these extremely poor strategic choices have meant that Canada's reputation is significantly tarnished on the international stage, and that increasingly, as the AUKUS agreement also shows, our closest allies aren't really taking us seriously anymore. And so what risks happening is that our closest allies in Washington and in Europe will basically say, look, Canada, you're abrogating your obligations to your partners and allies, so we're just going to go it on our own. You know, if you don't want to invest, if you don't want to be active, if you don't want to export natural resources, if you don't really want to be relevant, that's okay. But the result is we'll have no close friends that can help us to assert our interests, let alone amplify our interests. We'll be a medium-sized country, relatively in the middle of nowhere, with no one else who really wants to take us seriously.
It seems like Canada's story is at a bit of a crossroads. The next chapter needs to be written, and to be honest, I don't really want to lose that vision of Canada that I had as a kid growing up. I want to live in that friendly, happy country where everyone is accepted, where people are polite and small talk is governed not by conflict, but by who won the hockey game last night. But all that comes with a price. We have to defend it to protect what it means to be Canadian. And we need to understand that this isn't free or cheap. That to live in a country that defends human rights, stands up for social justice, fights for the truth, promotes diversity, well, if that's the story that we want to write, we may just need to pay attention more to the world around us and what we're up against. Thank you to Christian Leprecht for coming on the show today. You can find links to his work in the show notes. Also, heads up, we will be taking a break from our regular lineup next week as we are going to be attending the CANSEC conference in Ottawa. So our next episode will be focused on Canadian defense, cybersecurity, and yes, intelligence, including open source. So if you want to hear from the best and brightest in Canada and what keeps them up at night, make sure you click that subscribe button to know when that episode drops. please also go ahead and give us a rating and review. It really helps the show get noticed. For more, visit www.cloakanddagger.blog. I'm MJ Benias. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you here next time.
Come on, acknowledge.